and welcome to Powerhouse Politics. I'm ABC News Chief White House Correspondent Jonathan Carl.
And I'm ABC News Political Director Rick Klein.
So, Rick, a little bit of confusion here this morning. We were reporting last night that the White House had decided that it was near time to dissolve the coronavirus task force. Vice President Pence said on the record to a group of reporters that the coronavirus task force would likely be dissolved sometime around Memorial Day. The president seemed to confirm it when he was asked about it out in Arizona, but also cautioned this doesn't mean that I'm saying mission accomplished me when it's all over. But now this morning, we have a new tweet from the president.
And it looks like the task force is back. And it, to me, John, this is just a tiny example of the conflicting messaging that's coming from all levels of government at this moment, because you really have two big different things happening and they at the same time, and they're working sometimes in very opposite directions. You have a country that's in the middle of a public health crisis with no real end in sight, despite some plateauing of numbers. We don't have a vaccine. We don't have a cure. We don't have a realistic timetable here. But you have a country that is itching to get back to work and back to life. And you have a president who is talking about the need for the country to be one of warriors, but also his own need to be a cheerleader. And I feel like we're stuck somewhere in that middle land right now at a very tenuous time with a lot of very difficult political choices, because the country is anxious in both of those directions at the same time. So that's why you have a task force that's on again, off again, and now on again.
And so the president, in his tweet, saying that the task force will continue on indefinitely, but he says the focus will be on safety and opening up our country again, saying that he may add or subtract people, and also mentioning that the real focus in terms of the medical side of this will be on vaccines and therapeutics, which sounds like basically they're going to be doing what they've been doing. But today on Powerhouse Politics, in just a few minutes, we're going to bring in somebody who I believe is one of the most trusted voices on anything related to health, and that is Dr. Richard Besser, who we remember very fondly here at ABC News as our medical editor, a former acting director of the CDC, now running the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. We're going to talk to him in a few minutes. But we also, David Muir, had an interview with the president out in Arizona, and there were some interesting comments on what you just mentioned, this notion of the president as cheerleader. Take a listen.
I banned people from coming in January. Now, at the same time, I want to be optimistic. I don't want to be Mr. Gloom and Doom. It's a very bad subject. I'm not looking to tell the American people, when nobody really knows what's happening yet, oh, this is going to be so tragic. I want to be, aside from everything else, and I'm going to use a term, and some people love it and some people hate it, but I love it. I want to be a cheerleader for our country. I don't want to be Mr. Doom and Gloom. So here I am in January banning. At the same time, I want to be optimistic.
By the way, I don't know if anybody either loves or hates the term cheerleader. I've never seemed to me to be a real lightning rod term. But the president has said that he likes to be, you know, putting the most optimistic spin on things here, you know. I mean, and there you have it. But, you know, I got to tell you, there are still, to me, real questions about the thing that the president mentions most often, which is the decision to ban air travel from China. And he portrays this as the decision that saved America from the pandemic. Well, we know America wasn't saved from the pandemic. It was almost certainly the right decision. We do know that there were Democrats who criticized the decision, and Joe Biden, although he didn't specifically mention it the next day, you know, accused the president of being xenophobic, obviously a clear reference to what he had done here. So, you know, I think that when you're looking back at the history of this, that was a critical moment. But what I still haven't gotten a handle on here is there were 40,000 people who came into the United States from China after the ban went into effect. Now, the president points out that's because the ban did not apply to American citizens. But the question I've asked, and I've heard nothing really reliable on this, is in hindsight, you would have put those people into quarantine or tested them. And the president has suggested he did that. That is not true. People came back in. They were not tested. We didn't have anywhere near the capacity to test 40,000 people at that point. And there was no, system-wide policy to have people quarantine themselves after they came back.
And John, as you know, I mean, with the China ban and then later the partial ban on travel from Europe, those were happening with the disease already here. And yes. The issue of transmissions were not just about people coming in from other countries. They could have been American citizens coming back after that time, but the disease was already here. The president was minimizing this threat all through the months of February and the beginning of March. That's on the public record. And look, we're at a point now where the president is acknowledging that the reopening is almost certainly going to cost lives. And one of the reasons for that is the patience of the American people. And another one is this testing issue that you get at, that even now we're not able to guarantee universal testing. The president's been consistent on that there is and should be enough testing capacity all around for anyone who wants it to get it. That is still not the case today. And it is the case that people are going back to work, in some cases being forced back to work in states that are reopening without knowing about where the disease actually is fully, even whether they themselves and their loved ones might be carrying the disease.
And then, because we are the Powerhouse Politics podcast, there's the question of how does this affect the presidential campaign? I mean, in any other world, we would be in the midst of campaign season. And the president was asked by David whether or not he believes that this is going to essentially be this election is essentially going to be a referendum on how he's handled this crisis.
And if November becomes a referendum on your handling of the pandemic, are you comfortable with that?
Well, I am and I'm not. It's a very interesting thought. You know, I built the greatest economy and then it was turned off for good reason. We saved millions of lives by doing it. I think people are going to remember that. I think they're going to remember that I rebuilt the military. I think they're going to remember that I gave them the biggest tax cuts in history. I gave them the greatest regulation cuts by far in history. I've given them the best job numbers in history.
And Rick, by the way, that's the answer I give the first part when people say, "Are you comfortable with Rick Klein as the co-host of Powerhouse Politics?" I am, and I'm not. You know, I am, and I'm not.
I say the same about our chief White House correspondent time to time. It's true. It conveniently leaves the president on both sides, on every side of that essential question. I think it's a telling exchange in a couple of ways. One, that the president is trying to take credit for confronting, but also casting blame for the shortcomings of others. That is very much part of his response to this. And also the terminology he uses of I gave them, I gave you, his view of leadership, very malleable, but when it reflects well on him, he is very willing to take credit. And look, 6 months away, almost to the date, to the election right now, to know where things will stand with this virus, with the economy, with questions around his leadership, with questions around Joe Biden, it's impossible to know. Very possible that we are seeing a country that is on the mend by November. But wow, what a shock to the system that we've experienced over these last 2 months.
And Rick, you have heard me passionately make the case that as we go forward, that we need to, if not literally give equal time, pay attention to what is going on both sides of this campaign. We cannot be simply talking about Donald Trump. There is another candidate in this race. With that in mind, I guess we better talk about Joe Biden. What do you got?
Yeah, so obviously this has been an interesting week for Joe Biden. He came out to publicly address sexual assault allegations from a woman, Tara Reid. We've been reporting extensively on this, and anyone that has questions about it, please read up on it. I'm sure you've seen his interview. You've seen the holes in Tara Reid's story. You've also seen a parade of vice presidential hopefuls back up Joe Biden, say, "That's not the man that I knew." Other than that, John, we haven't seen that much of Vice President Biden. We've seen him, even with the president on the road this week, we haven't seen Vice President Biden leave his basement. And I was struck, John, by a very interesting op-ed in the New York Times. It was politics. It was political. Maybe it didn't get as much traction as it would have. But the byline was David Axelrod and David Plouffe. Those are the guys that made Joe Biden Vice President Biden, the architects of the 2008 campaign for Barack Obama. And their message to Joe Biden is pick up the pace, buddy. start to break through. Try to put some meat on the bones of that campaign. And an op-ed like that, John, does not get written unless there are real concerns about how this campaign is handling things. And yes, the polls would suggest that Joe Biden's in a strong position, but there are a lot of Democrats worried that when the dust settles on this, that the Biden campaign will not be where it needs to be to compete with the Trump machine.
No doubt. Well, it's going to be a challenge. I mean, because you also get a sense from some Democrats that the idea of Biden kind of laying low is not a bad idea. So we'll see. We'll see where he. I mean, this is such an odd campaign. I mean, normally we would be out. We would have our embedded reporters on the Biden campaign. We'd have a correspondent traveling covering the events. We'd have, I mean, and here we are. You know, how do you cover somebody who's at home? I mean,
and not knowing what the other side of it looks like. And look, I've gotten that argument from the Biden campaign directly, that the president, one president at a time, and he's, you know, he will pass or fail based on his own performance. And so far, it hasn't been a great one. But there are a lot that could be done right now in terms of digital organizing and preparing for the reality of a changed political environment that it doesn't seem like it's happening, at least not yet.
Okay, let's take a quick break. On the other side, we will be talking to Dr. Richard Besser. Welcome back to Powerhouse Politics, and joining us now is Dr. Richard Besser, the president and CEO of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, former acting director of the CDC, and most importantly, the former ABC News medical editor and a good friend of ours. Dr. Besser, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
I've been eager to talk to you to get your take on where it's going. So I just want to ask you a really basic question of where do you see this virus going? What is life in America gonna look like in the months ahead?
Yeah, that's the question everyone wants the answer to, and it's the fundamental question that we don't have an answer to. And you know, Dr. Fauci laid it out a couple months ago, I think pretty clearly, in that we don't determine the timeline, the virus does. And, you know, I led emergency response at CDC for 4 years. And during every new emerging infection outbreak, people wanted to know the answer to that. And you don't know early on. And unfortunately, we still are really early in this pandemic.
But there's this sense that we're going to begin reopening now. Obviously, you see the various governors begin reopening. You hear the president talk about moving to that phase. Is there any reason to believe that this is going to begin to level out and become more controllable over the summer, that this summer will somehow be to some degree past this?
Well, I don't think so. I'm open to being wrong. We don't know yet whether this is a virus that will become less active in hot weather. A lot of respiratory viruses don't like heat and humidity, and so it would be terrific if there's less disease activity. I worry, though, that as states start to open up their economies, get more people back to work, which is something everyone wants to see happen. But as they do that without having in place the public health measures, the trends in disease, the support systems that we all feel are necessary, if they do this without that in place, that many places are going to see their healthcare systems overwhelmed, just like we saw in New York. And that's going to lead to deaths that could have been prevented.
Dr. Besser, I was struck by something that you told Anderson Cooper the other night that I wanted you to expand on a little bit in the context of reopening. You made the point about the disproportionate impact of this virus on people of color, on minority communities, on lower income communities. Yeah. I'm curious for some context around that, and also whether that could be reflected in the reopening as well, when you have so many people from these communities who will be declared essential workers and then potentially forced to go back to work potentially prematurely.
Yeah, I'm very concerned about those issues. Those are things at the foundation that we are really, really focused on. Clearly, this pandemic is hitting everybody. But the burden of this is falling disproportionately on Black Americans, Latinos, Native Americans, lower income workers. And there are a number of reasons for that. One is that those groups of a very high proportion fall into categories that we consider to be essential. So frontline workers, whether it's in healthcare, or public safety, food supply, transportation. If you're able to work from home and work remotely during this, and if you've got enough savings that you're not having to make those tough decisions, this is a very inconvenient time, but it's not a time where your life is at risk. If you're somebody, though, who has to make the choice between staying home and protecting yourself and your family and your community, or going out to work so you can put food on the table and pay rent, you know, that's a very different kind of decision. And Blacks, Latinos, low-income workers are forced to make that decision much more. And you add on top of that much higher rates of the underlying medical conditions that put people at risk, so heart disease, diabetes, lung problems, a lot having to do with worse environmental conditions in which people live. That means that not only is the exposure risk increased, but the chances of having a bad outcome are higher. Those are two of the factors. The two pieces, though, that I think we can really do something about. You can't change whether or not someone has diabetes, but you can ensure that every worker who's going back to work or is working currently has the protective equipment that they need to minimize their risk. And for each person who becomes infected or who has contact with someone who's infected, that we're providing a safe place for them to isolate and food and medication to be able to do that for 2 weeks. Some countries have done that, but here in America, what we basically say to someone is, you're infected, go home and self-isolate. And if you live in an apartment or a house with elderly relatives or other people who are high at risk, you're basically saying to that person, go home, and I'm sorry that you are going to put your family members at risk.
And Dr. Besser, something I wanted to ask you about, given your time working in the Obama administration. The president told our colleague David Muir something in an interview yesterday that he said a few times that when he came into office, the cupboard was bare. Things were not ready to go. You didn't have enough in terms of testing, in terms of ventilators, in terms of federal response plans. He left the impression that the Obama administration left disaster preparedness, emergency medical preparedness in utter disarray. Is that your understanding of the situation that President Trump inherited? I know you were there in the earlier years of the Obama administration, but does that ring any bells with you? Does that jive with reality to your mind?
Well, there are pieces of that that jive with reality. And one of the things that you see in all political administrations, you saw it in the Bush administration, the Obama administration, and the Trump administration, is that it's very easy for elected officials to say, we're not going to put the money in to maintain our public health system. So you've seen over the past 15 years, the loss of close to 60,000 jobs in state and local public health. And these are the people who are doing lab testing. These are people who are doing contact tracing that you want to be able to have communicating with communities, doing all of the work, tracing diseases, working to control diseases. And those systems are not where they should be. But the piece that doesn't ring true is that, you know, the CDC is the world's strongest public health agency. And they should be out front here. They should be out front here talking to the public, explaining what they're doing, explaining why we're being asked to make changes to our life and what that can do in terms of protecting ourselves and those around us. And also explaining when guidance changes. You know, in every outbreak, which you know at the beginning, is minuscule. And you have to make decisions based on limited information, on expert opinion. And as you gain new information, you want to change your guidance so that it's consistent with the best science. If public health isn't out front in with that messaging, if it's all being done by politicians, half the public's going to discount it at face value based on who the political messenger is. And no one will be able to know what's being told as a change based on new information and science versus what's being done for political reasons. And that's the situation we're in right now.
All right, Dr. Besser, we have so much more we'd like to ask you, but I know you've got to run, but we hope we can check in with you again here on Power House Politics, and it's really great to talk to you.
Great talking to you, John, and to you, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you.
So, thanks so much.
Rick, for, you know, first of all, Richard Besser is one of the just one of the great. I mean, one of the person that I want to go to when I want to ask about anything medical. You know, yeah. such a voice of reason. But I thought his answer to you on you know on the Obama administration was an interesting one. In typical Besser, he's measured and he's blunt.
Yeah, and I keep thinking about people who've made their lives around preparing for pandemics. They've gone most of their lives being the boy who cried wolf, right? The awful thing didn't happen for all of the previous concerns. We've obviously had huge public health emergencies. But nothing like this, nothing like this. So was government prepared for this? I think the pretty clear answer is no, because there was not a way to get to that level of preparedness, to get the country on board for it, to get political leadership on board for it. But was the cupboard bare? Was it all, you know, did Donald Trump start from absolute zero in terms of emergency preparedness when he became president? No. And even what he told David Muir, that you know, he was busy for the first 3.5 years. It's not just a problem with President Trump's leadership. There's no question. But it's also not accurate to say that it was the previous administration's fault in any way, shape, or form, that the country was not ready for this. This is a once in a century thing, maybe once in more than a lifetime type of episode. And the other point that I think Dr. Besser makes is that are we really ready to reopen? It's happening. And, you know, John, I've been around town a little bit here in Washington, and it feels to me like people are itching to go when the weather got nicer and people are kind of bursting at the seams, ready to resume their lives. But the question of whether it's actually safe is very much an open one.
Yeah. And, you know, that's why I asked that very open-ended basic question in the beginning here. But there's one thing that I think we've all kind of deluded ourselves on, which is this notion that somehow the summer comes and things are better. I mean, we don't know. The experts, I mean, Besser's one of the experts, don't know if this virus, you know, fades away in the summer months, as a lot of respiratory viruses do. Maybe. And maybe it fades away only to come back in the fall, but we don't know any of that. So on that note, Rick, let's get back to work and let's make a point to check in with Dr. Besser at least every other podcast, even if it's a quick check in. Let's check in with him. But thank you for joining us here on Powerhouse Politics. Thank you to Trevor Hastings, Avery Miller, and our entire Powerhouse Politics team. We will be back next week.